More at CapitalOne.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, corporations are making a good profit housing prisoners. Many of the undocumented immigrants who've entered the country illegally are being held in for-profit facilities. What's it like to be a guard in a private for-profit prison? It's a growing business, and we'll speak with an investigative reporter who went inside a prison in a moment and worked there for several months. But first, three listener comments about yesterday's program. The topic yesterday was the limited income facing high school graduates this year because workers' wages remain chronically low. Here's what three listeners had to say.
This is Jim from Riverview. I wanted to call in and say the last guy that you had on the show, very interesting. I wish he had a little bit more time. He was going right to the crux of the matter. Everybody that is left behind by automation needs to be given a chance to live, you know, and that's the bad thing about capitalism. It's turned into cannibalism because it's all the money that goes to the top. The workers don't really have a say anymore, and none of the companies, well, most of the companies aren't loyal to their employees anymore. They're just a number, and as soon as they can do without you, you're gone. And as H. Ross Perot said, nobody believed him, NAFTA, that great sucking sound of all of your jobs going overseas, it certainly came to pass. I don't know what was the matter with Clinton for doing that, but he did.
This is Kevin from St. Petersburg commenting on the show about high school graduates. There was a caller that suggested that roommates would be a good solution, and I would like to caution the listeners that that's a little bit too simplistic. Landlords typically require each and every tenant in a roommate situation to be liable for the whole rent, if you will, and a lot of roommate situations fail, and you'll find yourself really behind economically. To have a good budget, you want to have your largest bill be accommodated in 1 week's pay. We'll also advise against obligating yourself to a large rent bill where a roommate is involved.
Yeah, it's Rob, about you're talking about corporations. It is ironic. Our revolution in 1776 was against the king, state religion, and the British East India Company, a corporation with too much power and inherited wealth. Again, too much power. This is something I think people have totally forgotten, and a lot of people are trying to turn upside down. Thank you.
There you have three listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. Well, the U.S. incarcerates more people than any other country in the world. Our guest today is investigative reporter Shane Bauer, who took a job as a guard in a private prison and wrote about it in a new book. The number of people being held in for-profit private prisons is growing in the U.S. Before he went into the American prison, he had his own harrowing experience in prison in Iran. In 2009, he and two friends went hiking in Iraqi Kurdistan and mistakenly crossed into Iran. There he was in prison for more than 2 years. After his release, Bauer became an award-winning investigative reporter for Mother Jones. He applied for a job with the Correction Corporation of America in Louisiana, and he was hired at $9 an hour. He wrote a book about it called American Prison. Shane Bauer joins us right now on the phone. Shane, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Shane, what led you to want to go back to prison after your experience in Iran?
Well, after coming back home, I was really drawn into the American prison system, largely because we have the largest prison system in the entire world. And I had spent a few years after my imprisonment reporting on the prison system here and found, you know, it very difficult to get access to prisons. And I was also interested in particular in the for-profit side of our prison system. And those prisons are the most difficult to get access to. You know, they're run by private companies, so they're even getting kind of basic information that we could get through, like, public records laws don't apply often to these companies since they're not public institutions. So I, you know, had the idea of applying as a prison guard to get inside. And I filled out an application on the corporate website and started getting interview requests. And next thing I knew, I was moving to Louisiana and working in a $9-an-hour job.
Did you go in undercover?
Well, I mean, I didn't lie in my application. I put my current employer. I was working for Mother Jones Magazine. I didn't think that they would hire me, but I don't know that they read the application, to be honest. I mean, they were so desperate for employees. I worked as a guard like everyone else did in the end.
Did you have a secret camera tell us about the way you gathered the information.
Yeah, I did actually have I had a camera. I had a pen that recorded audio. And the reason I had those things is because I couldn't take notes constantly and didn't want to have to sort of rely on my memory. So when I wrote the book, I was able to go back to these recordings. So all of the dialogue in the book is verbatim what people said. So I basically did everything I could to make it as accurate as possible.
Our guest is Shane Bauer, and he went undercover, although he didn't lie, but he went undercover into a private prison in Louisiana. The book that he wrote about is called American Prison, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. So how much training did you get in this guards job in which you were paid $9 an hour?
I went through a month of training. There was very little kind of physical training, but I was in class with other cadets who were, poor people from the town, basically people who were desperate for work, single moms, kids out of high school, guys who, were trying to supplement their retirement. There were kind of some themes that came up a lot in training. There was, they would warn us that once we started on the job, we were going to realize that we were not making enough money for the job, and we were going to be tempted to smuggle in contraband and sell it to prisoners to try to make ends meet. The theme of liability came up a lot. They, trained us to not get in the middle of prisoners fighting. So our job was simply to tell them to stop. Essentially in doing so, we're, covering our liability if we go to court and we're not costing the company extra money, in case we would get injured ourselves.
So tell me about staffing. If you were to compare, you were at a private prison in the middle of Louisiana. If you were to compare staffing at a private prison in Louisiana to staffing at, let's say, a state prison in Louisiana, the number of guards per inmates. And if you were to look at your $9 an hour salary or your pay scale versus what's paid at a public prison, could you compare the two?
Yeah, in Louisiana at the time, I think if I remember right, the public prison was starting at $12.50 an hour versus our $9 an hour.
Neither one is very good. neither $9 an hour nor $12.50 an hour is very good.
Right, no, it's not. And this varies a lot state to state. California, for example, prison guards are paid very well. But even in Louisiana, the public guards, they would have pretty early on have opportunities for raises. At the prison I was at, there were guards that worked there 20 years that made exactly the same as I did, starting wage.
Wait a minute. They've worked for 20 years and they're still getting $9 an hour?
That's right. Yeah.
Wow. What about benefits? Did you get a pension? Did you get days off? Did you get health care? Did you get any other sort of benefits?
There was a basic health care that was offered that, you pay into a little bit, which is, I think, why a lot of, like, the single moms, for example, took the job. They needed health care for their kids. I don't remember retirement or other benefits aside from that. They gave us in training a phone number. They said if we're having mental health issues, we can call this phone number to talk to a counselor, and we get three sessions for free. free, and then after that, you know, we have to pay for that too.
Well, Shane Bauer went undercover in a prison in Louisiana that was operated by a private company, which used to be called CCA. Now it's called Core Civic, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. So give us a big picture in terms of the trend towards private prisons. Is it growing? How many do we have, like a 2.5 million people behind bars in this country, and what percent of them are being held in private facilities?
It's about 8% that are held in private prisons.
And is that a growing number? Is that a growing number?
That number is pretty stable. Where it is growing is in immigrant detention. Private prison companies control about 2/3 of the immigrant detainees. And, you know, new facilities are often private facilities there.
Well, just parenthetically, what do you make of all these reports? Here in Florida, 2,200 children are being held at a private facility in Homestead, Florida. They are undocumented immigrants who have either been separated from their parents or arrived at the border by themselves. Lawyers for the children say these are prison-like conditions. What do you make of those reports that say that the conditions are not very good at this private facility holding undocumented immigrants in South Florida?
It doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, there have been riots in these places because the conditions are so bad. I met guards who were filling in from other states at the prison in Louisiana who worked in these immigrant detention facilities. And the way they talked about it, you know, they're complaining about inmates the way the guards, you know, in a regular prison, complain about inmates. It's, you know, it's almost as if they forget that these people didn't commit a crime. You know, their only crime is crossing the border.
And that's not even a crime. That's a civil offense.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So is there much money to be made in private prisons?
There is, yeah. This company is bringing in in just revenue, you know, a couple hundred, I believe it's, I can't remember the number actually off the top of my head where they're bringing it, so I don't want to make a mistake there, but it is a lot of money that they're bringing in every year, and the money they're saving is actually marginal, you know, to the state. The Department of Justice did a study recently that said that the cost savings for these prisons were negligible. And the Obama administration, after this study, had actually decided to stop using private prisons. You know, they were not saving very much money. They were tended to be more violent and had less rehabilitative programs. They canceled private prisons, but the Trump administration, you know, shortly after Trump took office, reversed that decision. So it's, you know, it's back to where it was before.
I wanted to not get too far ahead. I asked you earlier about staffing levels. How would you compare the staffing levels at the private prison that you worked at versus a state prison?
There tend to be staffing issues throughout the prison system, but they are more extreme in the private prison. The prisoners, they know, I had no way to verify the actual staffing rates at the other prisons. It's not publicly available. But anecdotally, the prisoners, many prisoners told me that that the prison at Wynn was more chaotic and that there were less people working there. There was less security in general.
In your unit, just speaking personally for the time that you were there, in your unit, how many staff, how many guards did you have, and how many inmates did you oversee?
My unit was 350 inmates, and it was me and one other guard on the floor, and then there's one guard in a control room. The prison generally was 1,500 had 1,500 prisoners, and, you know, I would, every day when we would have our morning meeting, and I would count how many guards were there just to know how many were in the prison, and it, you know, varied day to day, but usually around 23, 24 guards for 1,500 prisoners.
Wow, and in your unit, three guards for 350 prisoners, you're outnumbered.
Right. Oh, yeah, by far.
Well, the book is American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. And our guest is the author, Shane Bauer. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. The 13th Amendment to the Constitution outlawed slavery. At least that's what I think many of us believe who looked at the Constitution. You point out in your book that the 13th Amendment did not really outlaw slavery, and this ties in to what's going on in prisons, both private and public, around the country. Tell us about the 13th Amendment, and did it really outlaw slavery?
The 13th Amendment outlawed slavery except as punishment for a crime. So this left a loophole where people in the South, throughout the country, could use prisoners as slaves. And in the South, a lot of the men who had owned slaves then turned to the prison system and leased prisoners from the state. So as soon as the Civil War ends, the prison systems throughout the South are all privatized. Prisoners are leased to former slave owners, and they're leased to companies, major companies, including U.S. Steel Company. They labor for free from dawn until dusk. They're driven by the whip, just like slaves were. They're tortured. There are many laws that essentially drive people into prison, into these labor camps for minor crimes. And it was a really brutal and deadly system. It was the death rate in some states was as high as 1 in 4 prisoners per year were dying. This is comparable to the Soviet gulag.
So if the 13th Amendment allowed slavery to still exist in prisons, does it still exist today? Would you say, based on your experience there at the private prison in Louisiana, that you saw slavery-like conditions?
Today the prisoners are not, the profit is not from the prisoners' labor. I mean, through most of American history, really from the beginning of the country until roughly the 1970s, the main motive of incarceration was forced labor, and that labor was turning into profit either for a private businessman or for the states themselves. What this modern day kind of private prison system did was take out the labor out of the equation. So today the prisoners themselves are essentially the commodities. So the companies are making money by warehousing these prisoners for the state. So the states will pay them a rate for each prisoner per day. And Louisiana was $30-some, in California $60-some. And then they also trade, the New York Stock Exchange. So they get money from investors that way. That's not to say that prisoners don't labor today. Prisoners throughout the prison system work, and usually for cents on the dollar, and their work is essential to running the prisons, but it's not forced in the way that it had been in the past, where every prisoner is being forced to labor. It's usually the labor today is most of it is used for the day-to-day functioning of the prison itself.
As I was reading your book, the low pay for these workers, for the prisoners, rather, jumped out. I mean, not only you as a guard, you're paid $9 an hour. You're not paid very much. And the prisoners, as you said, for essential services within the prison are paid very little. And then is my understanding that some people were manufacturing products, too. Talk about the rate of pay for people that did, let's say, essential jobs like kitchen work at the prison, and then the people that were manufacturing or helping to manufacture products. Talk about the pay scale that they were given.
Oh, we're talking, 10, 15, 20 cents an hour. You'll hear prison systems talk about, they'll say this is voluntary. They're not required to do this labor. But if you're in a prison for 10, 20 years, oftentimes you lose connection with the outside. You don't have people putting money in your commissary. And, the only way that you can make phone calls, everything costs money in prison, is to work these jobs. So it's even debatable how voluntary it is. I mean, if you're somebody in prison with zero money, you're going to be in a very bad position.
Well, what costs money in prison? What do you have to pay? What do you use the money that you have for?
Phone calls cost money. Being able to send messages to the outside costs money. Letters, you know, even just buying stamps, of course, costs money. And then a lot of prisoners, you know, prisoners that have money, the food is so bad that they will buy food from the commissary. And, you know, this isn't great food either. We're talking like beef jerky, ramen packets. And but that food is better than the food that's offered in the cafeteria. So they'll essentially make meals out of the commissary, or at least supplement their meals through the commissary. Also, prisoners buy soap, shampoo, a lot of these basic things that they need.
If a prisoner is being paid 2 cents an hour or 15 cents an hour for a job, how is that legal? How is it legal to employ somebody to do work, but then only pay them a tiny, tiny fraction of the minimum wage?
Well, this goes back to the 13th Amendment. You know, it's still legal for, you know, the 13th Amendment still stands, which says that slavery is abolished except for punishment for a crime. So under that, you know, anything goes in terms of pay, at least.
What kind of people, you were, what town were you in Louisiana?
I was in Winfield, Louisiana.
And where is that?
It's in north central Louisiana.
And you're in the middle of a national forest, is that right?
The prison is, yeah.
Prison is. Okay, so what kind of prisoners were there? Were these hardened criminals like, you know, murder and armed robbery? Or what? I mean, what was the range of crimes? And do private, for-profit prisons skim off the easy-to-handle prisoners?
It was a mix. It was a medium-security prison, so you had everything from somebody had too many DUIs to somebody convicted of murder who had been in the system for years and worked his way down the security level through good behavior. You know, rape, theft, it was really a pretty wide range.
Well, the book is American Prison. The author is Shane Bauer. He's with us live. And if you've got a question for Shane, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Shane, I know you're a busy guy. Do you have some more time to spend with us?
I think I have 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay.
Well, so my next.
There are so many other questions I want to ask you. Well, okay, let's go back to 2009. You make a mistake. You're with two friends. You inadvertently cross from Iraqi Kurdistan over to Iran. You're put in prison, I think, for 26 months. How would you compare the prison, the experience that you had in prison for those months in Iran, to what you saw as a guard looking from the outside into the cell in Louisiana?
I mean, it's, you know, it's always difficult to compare these two systems, but I was in a political ward of the prison. So I was with, you know, pro-democracy activists. People were tortured physically, interrogated. I was in solitary confinement for 4 months. It was in some ways a very highly controlled environment. You know, you leave the cell, you have to wear a blindfold, you don't get to interact with other prisoners. And Wynn, in some ways, was like the opposite end of the spectrum. It was just chaos. It was really violent. You know, the prison in Iran, at least the part of the prison I was in, there wasn't violence between prisoners that I ever saw. At Wynn, it was rampant. And, you know, there was very little security. So, you know, it... and the healthcare, I think, was worse as well. So it was really kind of different sets of issues in each system.
I got to ask you this, and it's way, way, way off topic. There's talk about going to war with Iran, that John Bolton, I think, is leading the charge in Washington, D.C. You, I think, had a really tough time in Iran. What's your take, just, and this is way outside your book, way outside what we've been talking about, but war with Iran, what do you think?
Oh, I think it would be a disastrous thing. I mean, I think if we go to war with Iran, it's going to make the Iraq war look like a cakewalk. I don't think it's in anybody's interest to do that.
All right. Well, Shane Bauer, thanks a lot. Thanks for spending all this time with us.
Thank you.
All right. That's Shane Bauer. Shane is the author of a book called American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. And he's also an award-winning author, writes for Mother Jones Magazine. And the book is now out in paperback. But as you heard, before he was a prison guard in North Central Louisiana, he was held... He was held in prison in Iran for 26 months when he inadvertently walked from Iraq into Iran and was captured by the Iranians. That's an interesting story. He wrote a book about that, too. Well, you're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And we're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. The email address here is dj@wmnf.org. There's a lot that we can talk about. I'm going to suggest a few things in a moment. Let me just read some of the emails that we've gotten in so far about the prison issue. Bubba writes this. You might have mentioned this one, but the biggest private prison company's headquarters is in Florida. That's the GEO Group. I found it fascinating how citizen action and protest prevented GEO from getting naming rights to Florida Atlantic University to their football stadium in 2013. Loved the nickname for this debacle. It's called Alcatraz, O-W-L-C-A-T-R-A-Z. Are the Owls the mascot for Florida Atlantic? That shows how little I know about FAU. Kevin writes this. Please talk about the occupancy guarantees that private prisons have in their contracts, which makes the state pay for anything less than 96% filled beds. Because of this, lawmakers may have a conflict of interest when creating laws to fill prisons. Yeah, that was one of the topics I wanted to ask him about. Kevin, I think you got that right. My memory from the book is that the state pays not for 96%, but if the prison is 95% occupied or less, then the state is on the hook for the missing prisoners, so to speak. So I think you got that essentially right, Kevin, and maybe I got it wrong. But the state does guarantee that private prisons will have extra money if their beds are not 95% filled or more. And that's a problem. 813-239-9663. And then Chuck in Tampa writes, thanks to the fake news media and WMNF's support is up to 43.9% Real Clear Politics. Rasmussen has him at 52%, highest yet. Wow. I guess talking about wage rates or children at the border just isn't moving the needle, writes Chuck in Tampa. Chuck, thank you for your email. I think Chuck would like to not talk about prisons, but that's okay. We can talk about whatever's on your mind. We're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls at 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Story that we've been covering a lot here on WMNF, the Hillsborough Metropolitan Planning Organization voted last night to keep two controversial Interstate 275 projects in the county's five-year transportation plan. One project would widen I-275 in both directions from MLK Boulevard to Bierce Avenue, and the other would add another ramp to exit I-275 southbound to I-4. The vote does not guarantee that two projects would ever be funded or built, but it does keep them as an option moving forward. And the latest data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics shows the annual average salary for Floridians was $46,000 last year. That's up by 2.7% from the year before. But compared to the rest of the nation, Florida's average annual paycheck lags. It's nearly 12% lower than the national average, which is just shy of $52,000. The U.S. Justice Department announced yesterday it has reached a settlement agreement with Sam Williamson Farms. That's a strawberry farm in Dover and eastern Hillsborough County, with the company agreeing to pay about $85,000 in back pay to farm workers. What the farm did was it claimed it couldn't find domestic workers, so it hired 300 H-2A workers, foreign workers, and gave them visas to come in and do some strawberry picking. and the investigation into that was as recent as 2017. Bernie Sanders, the Democratic presidential candidate, today will give a speech, a major speech, defining what he means by democratic socialism. We should hear reports about that later today. And, of course, Richard Wolff yesterday on Economic Update spent his half of his show talking about his definition of socialism. I hope you got to hear that. Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Bradley, who's in Tarpon Springs, with our first call today. Hi, Bradley. You're on WMNF.
Yes.
Bradley, take it away.
Thank you for taking my call. Congratulations to your guest. Success. I read the recent article in the Mother Jones magazine, I believe that your guest had written.
Yeah, correct? part of the book was in the recent Mother Jones magazine, yeah.
And the question I have is regarding the Islamic State, what they're being called. It's written here that they were formed by Abu Baghdadi in 2013. Is it not the same or a branch of the same group that was formed in 2000 or after the Iraq invasion, about 2003, by the man Abu Musa Zarqawi, who was killed by a drone strike? That is what we were told previously. So this information that the group was actually recently formed appears to be accurate. But how is it that we were previously told that the group was branched out of this man in 2003?
Yeah, you know, Bradley, I got to say, I would have to read back over the history of that group, because I don't have it in front of me, and I hesitate to speak off the top of my head. So you may be right. Not sure that that's at the top of everybody's minds these days, but thank you for your phone call. And I got to say, I'm really not prepared to talk about that, just because I don't have the material in front of me, and I'm not conversant with it right now. Here's an email from 239. It says, sadly, it appears Chuck is right. A very large percentage of this country is stupid enough to believe the brainwashing that he cites. 239, that's that email. Okay, let's go to Teresa in St. Pete. Hi, Teresa, you're on WMNF. What's on your mind today?
I left a message the other day about the immigrant children. You asked if they were, you know, if they were white, would they be treated like this? But I guess you didn't get it. My phone sometimes breaks up.
Well, I'll tell you, Teresa, yeah, I should say this to everybody. When you record a message on my comment line and it's fuzzy or incomprehensible, I don't usually play it back. Just because it's very hard for listeners to try to decipher when a phone is breaking up. So my best advice to everybody who calls and leaves a comment is that there's a way when you call in to listen back to your comment to make sure it properly recorded. And what you hear when you listen back to it is what people will hear over the air. And the other thing I would say, too, is that if people could make their comments 40 seconds or less. But anyway, that's what happened, Teresa. It wasn't that I didn't want to play your comment. It just was, it was indecipherable.
Sometimes does that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I was just saying that, yeah, you know, if these children were white, they would not have been separated from their parents. They would not be put in these prison type things or concentration camps, whatever you want to call them. They would have been kept together. And my husband said, we were talking about it one time. He said, nah, they probably would have put them up in like a Four Seasons, a four-star restaurant or a hotel if they were white coming from Europe. And I was just like, okay, probably, because, you know, they only seem to be concentrating at the border of where the black and brown people are coming in, and all the ones that come from Europe that overstay their visas, we don't hear anything about.
Yeah, we know a large percentage of people from other countries besides developing nations that happen to be Hispanic. Yeah, a lot of people are coming from other countries, true.
Yeah, Teresa, they don't seem to care. It's just these, you know, these poor people that are running for their lives. Their lives aren't worth anything to these so-called, you know, pro-life people. So I guess they're just pro-white life. I don't know.
All right, Teresa.
I just tried to understand that, and I still don't get it. Okay, well,
Teresa,
you have a great day.
You too. Thanks a lot, Teresa. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Let's go to Charles in Tampa. Charles, you're on. What would you like to say?
I tuned into the dialogue with the author late, so I may have missed some things. I just wanted to remind people of Michelle Alexander's research and her book, The New Jim Crow, which touches on many of the things he mentioned. There is leasing that takes place in prisons. I know in South Carolina and maybe even in Georgia and some of the other southern states, they do lease out prisoners to do work. And that's been, that research has been done. So I don't know how much she's aware of that, and I don't know how much he covered, but it's a very tragic phenomenon in this country. And on the other things, the pink elephant in the room, as immigration goes, is the fact that bigotry is still very much alive and well in this country. And we know that there is a dual system when it comes to the way people of color are treated versus people who are of European descent.
Yeah, he does cite Michelle Alexander in his bibliography, and I think he's pretty familiar with her great book that came out in 2010. But when you say leasing of prisoners, tell us some more about what you mean by that.
Well, what I learned from the research that was done by Reverend Jackson and Rainbow Push is that these people are leased up and do specified jobs. You can go to the Rainbow Push site, and I think you can get some additional information that I probably can't cover here. And you can also research it because there's still what was called in the past convict leasing, where they lease prisoners out to companies. And I think they're under guard, and they may go to farms or to agricultural scenes or to do particular work off-site even. And they're transported in prison vehicles to these places. They're given minimal wages, and the prison takes most of that. So there's still some of that going on, and I can't delineate the entire nature of it, but there is still convict leasing where companies use prisoners for profit.
Yeah, I think that's true. All right, Charles, thanks a lot. I know that in some prisons they're used as call centers. There are prisons that are making garments. And I was shocked by in reading American Prison that some of the workers were paid 2 cents an hour. And that was for things like working in the kitchen to feed the other prisoners. And some people were making objects for sale in the book American Prison. And they were paid somewhere around 20 or 30 cents an hour. How is that right? I mean, if you're employing somebody and you're saying, okay, your job for the next 4 hours is to cook breakfast for 350 inmates, how is it legal to pay them 2 cents an hour? How? I mean, even if you are a prisoner, you should still get paid. And wouldn't we all as a society benefit if, let's say that they were able to save that money and not spend it in prison? That way, when they got out after 20 years or whatever, that they had a nest egg that they could buy a car or maybe, you know, rent an apartment right away and maybe put some money down on a house, you know, after 20 years in prison. It would certainly keep, I think, the incarceration rate low. But what do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Charles, thanks for that. Let's go to David in Lake Wales. David, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, good morning, Rob.
Good morning.
Wanted to let you know I did read American Prison by Shane Bauer last fall. And it's quite eye-opening and disturbing. Really, slavery didn't end. It just changed forms because, and of course, it was mostly in the Deep South, no surprise. And unfortunately, a large percentage of the people were black, but they would lock you up for the most ridiculous offenses. And then you became part of the prison system and slave labor. And interestingly enough, you know, in some form, it's still going on today. And so now whenever I hear anything about prison-related things, I pay close attention. And, it, you know, I don't think too many people are aware of what's still going on, particularly in places like Alabama, Louisiana, et cetera, et cetera. So my point is it was really good to hear him this morning, and I would recommend the book to anybody that wants to learn a little bit more about what's going on in our prisons.
Yeah, I remember listening to Amy Goodman's interview with him a few months ago or a few years ago, and it was terrific. And you know, one of the things I didn't get to when Shane was on the air, we only had that 24 minutes or so, but Shane was pointing out in the book, and you've read this, that there's an incentive to lengthen the stay of prisoners so that these companies can continue to take in that $30 a day or whatever they're getting paid by the state, and that increases the company's profits. So if a prisoner does, you know, misbehave somehow, and he was on his way to getting out maybe a little early, the prison company on its own, without a trial, or as Shane says in his book, a 2-minute trial, could decide, well, you've been guilty of disciplinary infraction, so we're going to keep you in for another 30 days. Well, what that does is that extends the company's profits on that prisoner. When they were expecting to let him out, let's say May 1st, and the prisoner, in one case, the prisoner took a broom out of a broom closet, and that was his infraction, and he got put in for another 30 days because
That's
of
right.
that infraction.
And what this also leads to, of course, is understaffing, poor training for the staff, low wages, low quality food, all of these things, because it's all about making money for the prison system, the CEOs of the prison companies, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very dirty business. And thanks again for another good show, Rob.
All right, David, thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM, and we've got one open line. You'll be able to get through right away, though, if you call 813-239-9663. You can also email the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. There's a lot else going on. The MPO vote last night we could talk about. Low wages again here in Florida for yet another year. A chronic problem for years and years here. Some farm workers win some back pay in Dover in eastern Hillsborough County. Bernie Sanders giving a speech describing what he means when he says democratic socialism. These are all topics that we could talk about, and we can talk about anything else in the news. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And coming up in the next hour, Nola LaLaye will be here, and will be hosting his Midpoint program, so stick around for that. Let's go to Ron in Mango. Ron, you're on WMNF.
Hey, Rob, and thanks for having me. I miss you in the interim anyway, too. Miss having you on point.
Well, it's good to have been missed.
Yeah, but it's good to be on point, and that's what you are. So I appreciate somebody recognizing that. So anyway, I want to add a little bit to your conversation to keep you on topics that you were on already, and that is, since I heard you the other day saying you was going to have this subject, and I was debating on whether to call, but I really want people to understand this, and I think the governor should know. Up in Stark, Florida, somewhere up in there by Jacksonville, anyway, I have a relative or a person that works inside the prison, and he said that every week a prisoner dies in there. And what they die from is they make some kind of concoction out of cigarette, and they smoke the stuff, and it's lethal. And he said at first, they took all the chemicals away that they was making it with, but then they gave them better stuff to make the same thing. So he said they was like, he said they sit there and they watch the people die and everything. He said they put a roach spray or something on it, and they actually using that as an escapism, form of escapism. And I don't think nobody's really aware of that. That's really tragic. So
that is
some firsthand knowledge, and they do lease them out because he used to do the lease out job, and some guys approached him and told him they wanted his job and made him give it up. And they were of a different culture. I just leave it like that. And they used their power to do that to him. So, I've been talking to him about that. And he's a veteran, too, at that.
Well, yeah, Ron, and in fact, there's a similar story in the book in American Prison, because they do a Shane goes through and they talk about how they search cells. And one of the things they're searching for is Tylenol. And apparently some prisoners are combining Tylenol with something else and they smoke it to get high. I mean, that's how desperate they are to kind of take their minds off their situation. And so if they find Tylenol in the cell, that's material that's got to be removed by the guards.
Yeah, but they're not equipped to do any medical, Rob, I think is the biggest problem. And like I said, what was tragic about that is that he said they actually, the guys be asphyxiating and they can't do nothing. They just watch them and either they'll die or they'll be very ill.
Wow.
And it's a large number of them, too, that's right here in Florida.
Yeah.
I don't know. Plus, they farm them out because he used to go, he said he did the road. They used to take them out on the road and they make good money doing that. Like he might make $500 but they just taking them out there until they're side of the road.
Yeah, you know, and maybe your friend is in this position too. I've talked with people who are parents of prison guards that work here in Florida for the state prison system, and I'm told that the prison guards are only paid about $28,000 or $30,000 a year. So these are tough jobs. I mean, this guy that I just talked to, Shane Bauer, he was paid $9 an hour, which is low enough. But even in the state of Florida, where I think you'd want to have some people who are professional that don't get angry all the time and at least get some reward for their job, that they're only paid $28,000 or $30,000 a year. Well, what kind of life can you have on $28,000 a year?
I don't know, Rob, but I saw this a year ago up in North Florida, up in the panhandle off of 19. They have a big solar prison up there, and it was empty. I don't know how many people are in it now, but I have saw that, and that was kind of disturbing to me. It's way up in North Florida, and they do a lot of fishing and stuff up there, but they converting it into like a prison population.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ron, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call.
All right, thank you, Rob, and have a good day.
You too. Okay, this is WMNF in Tampa. Let's go to Kevin in Bradenton. Kevin, you're on.
Oh, hey, Rob. I just wanted to mention, as far as the amount of pay that the prisoners are getting, the 2 cents an hour or whatever. Well, you know, obviously, privatization is always about profit over people, at least in my opinion. And I was working in 2005 for a Metro United Way of Nashville, and while I have a great deal of respect for them and that the people that work there, I did see a check, one of those giant copies of a check, and it was from a CCA corporation, you know, at the time, and it was for $10,000. So, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that this is a very profitable business for these people, and because of that, I just don't think it's going to go away. So, I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I hope that people can come to their senses that we shouldn't be making a profit. I mean, this is ridiculous, in my opinion. And then when you tie everything in with Michelle Alexander's book or Shane's book, I haven't read that, but I did read hers. It does seem that the trend isn't going, even though our politicians kind of make us believe that they're doing everything they can to, you know, reduce prison populations and change some of the harmful laws. Myself personally, I don't buy it. And I think that the numbers belie what the politicians are telling us about prison reform.
Yeah, and one of the big questions is, why do we have 2.5 million people behind bars in this country for a variety of reasons? Some are in prison, some are in jail, some are in immigrant detention centers. But why do we have 1/4 of all the people behind bars on the planet? They're here in the U.S. What is it about our country where we lock up more people than any other country?
That is the question, but right now, like you say, there's so many other things going on that, I mean, a program like this is obviously really, really important, but many people out there would not have a clue that any of these things that we're talking about are actually going on, and that's the saddest thing about the people that, you know, refuse to listen to a station like WMNF, so... That's
all right.
About all I got, Rob.
Kevin, thanks a lot. Thank you for saying that. Well, this is WMNF in Tampa. Let me just play a little bit of what the Two of the candidates for president are saying President Trump, who, of course, is going to be in Orlando next Tuesday, kicking off his presidential campaign, and Joe Biden, both were in Iowa yesterday. Let's listen to a little bit of the back and forth between Biden and Trump yesterday and also get your take on this. Here's a report from the Associated Press.
This is Jim from Review. I wanted to call in.
With Biden, we would never be treated with respect. Because people don't respect him, even if the people that he's running against.
After earlier calling Biden a dummy, those remarks in Council Bluffs amounted to toning it down, as President Trump touted his get-tough trade policy. Later at an Iowa Republican Party dinner in West Des Moines, Trump laid off the direct insults of Biden instead attacking the Democratic Party.
Did you ever see a people so angry?
But he also laid out his vision of the GOP.
The Republican Party is the party of the American family, the American worker, the American farmer, and the American dream.
I'm Ben Thomas.
And here's one more report about yesterday.
Democrat Joe Biden says President Trump is damaging the U.S.
Tearing down the guardrails of democracy.
The American way of life.
A standard of crude language and embarrassing behavior.
And U.S. standing on the world stage.
He gets up in the middle of the night while he's at Normandy, and he tweets an attack on Bette Midler. The mayor of London, because he's Muslim. The speaker of the house, Nancy Pelosi, who's there with him in Normandy. A stunning display of childishness that the whole world watched.
Biden says Trump's trade wars are hurting U.S. companies and farmers.
He thinks these tariffs are being paid by China, just like he thinks Mexico is building a wall.
I'm Jackie Quinn.
All right, a little bit of the back and forth between the president and Joe Biden yesterday. Let's go to Steve in Sarasota. Steve, you're on. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Rob. Talking about the prison situation in America. Down in Sarasota here, we've had a sheriff here, Tom Knight, who recently, at a meeting between him and the prosecuting attorney, the county commission, public defender, told them, he said, I don't want another jail, which is amazing for a sheriff in the state of Florida. I'm just so delighted that we have that kind of person in office down here. Unfortunately, he's going to retire because he says 70-80% of the people he winds up with in jail, they don't belong in jail. But the politicians and the judges and the district attorney, they all want to see him in jail. And that group of people we call the Republican Party in Florida delights in putting people in jail. And it's just part of their continuing tradition of disenfranchising the poor, the minority, and the blacks. And until people like Tom Knight stand up and say, we don't need another jail for $100 million, $120 million, what we need are people elected who will face up to the problems that we have and direct money towards solving those rather than incarceration. And it's a continuation, as you know, throughout your life of following these things, of everything that happened in Reconstruction and on into the 30s, 40s, and 50s in all the southern states. How do we keep people from exercising the right of franchise? We put them in jail. We fine them. We make them pay violation of probation. Monies that they don't have. We put them into a state of perpetual poverty so that we can keep them from participating in a democracy.
You know, it's interesting that some countries, too, do let their prisoners vote in elections. And just two countries jump out. I think there's 20 or so countries that let prisoners vote, but Israel and Canada let their prisoners vote. But your point is a good one. The as Michelle Alexander points out in her book, New Jim Crow, the penalties are extreme, especially for people of color. And they have been disenfranchised by some of the policies that we've got, including, you know, very harsh drug laws for what should be minor offenses, and people are put in prison for a long time for marijuana.
Well, the whole thing of bail being used as a method of enriching people in the community is just bizarre.
Yeah.
It has no relationship to their potential danger. It's just, we'll keep you in jail until you pay the money.
Yeah.
If you don't have the money, we'll keep you in jail longer. But thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Steve. And let's go to Dave in Tampa. Dave, we just have 20 seconds.
Hey, Rob.
Hi, Dave.
I was held captive at the doctor's office the other day. I picked up a copy of Forbes magazine, and he was talking about capitalism. And he mentioned the Great Depression. One of the causes was caused by tariffs. And I looked it up, I had no clue if that was true or not. And it does. There are people that say it, some don't. But one of the five major causes were tariffs.
Yeah, I think that's true. Dave, sorry to say we're out of time. Dave, thanks a lot.
That's fine.
Thank you for pointing that out, too. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for NOLA. He's coming up next on the Midpoint program. I'm Rob Lori. Winston has been our phone producer today. This is